Well, I'm the last speaker, so I guess I'm going to get to introduce myself, unless there's somebody on the premises who wants to officiate. If people don't mind, I'm going to sit down, just sort of to start winding things down here. So let me move over here. No, that's okay. I'll do it.
Sorry. I'm not a...
I am David Sobel. I'm General Counsel for the Electronic Privacy Information Center in Washington. And thank you. I feel a little like Hendrix at Woodstock. For those of you who know what I'm talking about. You know, there's been a lot of great information up here, and I know everybody's really burned out, so I'll do the best that I can. I also am sort of weaning myself away from PowerPoint presentations, so I don't have that crutch. Thank you. So again, please bear with me if things are a little bit disjointed given the late hour of the proceeding. I've been sort of living in fear for the last few days of getting dragged up here as a suspected Fed, so I consider it a little bit of a personal triumph that didn't happen. So I consider myself ahead of the game before I even get started here. I am talking about anonymity under assault with a specific reference to the so-called John Doe lawsuits that have been popping up around the country. Just to talk a little bit about the importance of anonymity, we believe that anonymity is really a key feature both in terms of privacy protection and also the protection of free speech. So it's really critical for both of those reasons. And in fact, most of the issues that EPIC works on sort of have as a common denominator anonymity, assaults on anonymity, and attempts to preserve anonymity. For instance, in the free speech context, the Child Online Protection Act, which is the successor to the Communications Decency Act, which we're involved in challenging in federal court right now. Obviously, this is a content-based speech restriction on the internet. What a lot of people don't always recognize is that there's also an anonymity component to this issue, because if you're going to establish laws that say you have to be a particular age to access particular information, if you say anyone under 18 years of age cannot access particular information on the web, then obviously you're imposing an identification requirement as a condition of access. So a large part of the issue for us in that case is attempting to prevent us from going in the direction of doing age checks online, which obviously means that people are going to be identifying themselves as interested in accessing particular information. Anonymity is under assault right now, both by the government and the private sector. On the government side, I'll mention something that I don't think has been widely reported or noted, which is that FBI Director Free, in testimony before a Senate committee last year, suggested, and this was the first time any of us had heard this, that ISPs be required to capture caller ID information and maintain that information so that law enforcement could then come back to an ISP and say, we wanted to know who initiated this session, when they initiated it, and what the phone number that the session was initiated from was. So those kind of proposals are out there, and as far as I'm concerned, it could be just a matter of time before we really start to see some serious proposals coming out of law enforcement in the direction of making identification a mandatory requirement for going online. I also want to talk a little bit about what's going on in the private sector. Actually, I want to talk a lot about what's going on in the private sector. But you know, in terms of the government side of things, I think you all know what the rationales are for limiting anonymity. We hear these rationales all the time. We need to be able to track down child pornographers. In support of the critical infrastructure protection efforts, we need to identify people. And then, of course, there's plain old computer hacking that is always cited as a reason why there needs to be a means of identifying people online and knowing who's doing what. Now, in the private sector, it's a little bit less apparent, and I think this is the newer wrinkle that we're dealing with. On the private sector side of things, you now have people saying, well, because of the potential for defamation on the internet, we need to identify people who post things. Breach of contract issues. Companies say, we don't want former employees or current employees who have confidentiality agreements with us posting trade secrets online. We need a means to identify the people who are posting information. Copyright protection, of course, is another major rationale for building in the ability to identify people who are putting up information. Now, the legal framework that governs all of this is a little bit sketchy. The Electronic Communications Privacy Act, ECPA, at the federal level, is what governs the ability of either the government or a private person to get information about online subscribers. Now, when it comes to law enforcement, what ECPA says is that a subpoena must be presented before what they call subscriber information can be disclosed. That means, you know, who is the holder of this account, who has this email address, you know, tell us about this IP address, I mean, whatever the information is. When it's a governmental entity that's asking for the information, there does have to be a subpoena. On the private side, however, if your next door neighbor, if your boss, if you work for a private company, whoever, as long as they're not law enforcement, wants to get that information, federal law says nothing. So basically somebody can call up an ISP and say, who does this email address belong to? And there is nothing under federal law that prohibits the disclosure of that information to anyone for whatever reason they might have. Now, this problem, I guess, was illustrated the best last year in the case that involved Timothy McVeigh. Now, this is not the Oklahoma City bomber, Timothy McVeigh. This is the gay sailor, Timothy McVeigh. So, you know, talking about anonymity, I mean, think of the problem this guy has for the rest of his life. He always has to introduce himself saying, I'm not the Oklahoma City bomber, I'm the gay sailor. So this is someone who really has had a problem created because of careless handling of his personal information on the internet. Basically, the story in the McVeigh case was this guy is a naval officer based at Pearl Harbor. He has an AOL account, and he has a few screen names, one of which he has a profile for that identifies him as being gay, citing some of the interests he has in terms of his proclivities, but he has other clean screen names that he tries to use for official purposes. Well, one day he slipped up and he sent somebody that he dealt with in the Navy a message under the gay screen name. So this person receives this message and it has a very provocative email address attached to it. So they check the AOL profile for this user, and lo and behold, it says, my name is Tim, I live in Hawaii, my marital status is gay, etc., etc. So this individual calls this information to the attention of McVeigh's superiors, who then proceed to place a phone call to AOL without identifying themselves. They say, who does this screen name belong to? The guy on the phone says, wait a minute, let me check. That's Timothy McVeigh. He lives in Honolulu, Hawaii. The next thing McVeigh knows, he is brought up on a discharge proceeding for violating the don't ask, don't tell policy. And I won't get into the whole don't ask, don't tell aspect of the case because that was also interesting. But in terms of the privacy issues and anonymity issues involved, there were really two problems with what happened there. First of all, the Navy investigator did not identify himself as being a government agent, which under ECPA is what kicks in the subpoena requirement. So the guy at AOL was never put on notice that he was dealing with someone from the government. He didn't therefore know there was a subpoena requirement, so he gave out the information. But the other thing the guy at AOL apparently didn't know is that AOL's terms of service go further than federal law and say that in any case where that information is requested, AOL, as a matter of its terms of service, will require a subpoena. So there were really two violations here that occurred. The outcome of the case, I mean, aside from the fact that McVeigh's identity was disclosed and he now has this little problem that I mentioned in terms of identifying himself for the rest of his life, because of the procedural problems with the way the information was collected, a federal judge in Washington did in fact order his reinstatement. The discharge proceeding was ended. He was given an honorable discharge, early retirement, full benefits. So that case ended well. But the problem that it illustrated is that this is all really very sketchy in terms of the level of protections that most people have. We also saw an instance in the Melissa Virus investigation where apparently AOL was able to turn over caller ID information to law enforcement. So I think there are some interesting questions there about what was going on in that investigation and what it might say about the current law enforcement capabilities in terms of tracking people. Of course, the guy's other problem was that he had the Microsoft GUID in his documents, but we won't talk about that either. So that's sort of where things are legally in terms of ECPA. Now, what I specifically wanted to talk about are the so-called John Doe cases. We have seen the phenomenon over the last year of private companies filing lawsuits, issuing subpoenas for the identity of people who post things in online message boards. This has happened for a variety of reasons, like I cited earlier, defamation claims, copyright claims, breach of contract claims. But the problem is that there is no oversight in this process. So basically where we are right now is that anyone sitting in this room can file a lawsuit against anybody else, call it, you know, so-and-so versus John Doe. You then have a pending lawsuit. Your lawyer can then issue a subpoena to whatever ISP they want, to whatever message board they want, and say, this is the username, this is the email address, whatever the identifying information is, and get the information. The first case of this kind that any of us really heard of was only about a year ago. A Canadian company called Philips Services filed a suit and issued subpoenas to Yahoo, and ended up identifying a lot of the people who were criticizing the company in online message boards at Yahoo. Probably the best-known case was filed by Raytheon a while back against 21 John Doe defendants. And this was a case where Raytheon was arguing that it looked to them from the content of the postings that the people were insiders, that they were either current or former employees, and that there was a breach of confidentiality issue. Raytheon ended up identifying all 21 individuals. It apparently turned out that only four of them were employees. And once Raytheon succeeded in identifying the individuals, it dropped the lawsuit. I mean, meaning that they filed a case saying we have valid legal claims against these 21 individuals and therefore we need to identify them. Well, once they had the power of subpoena and identified the individuals, suddenly they were no longer interested in proceeding with the lawsuit. So this raised a lot of red flags to those of us who follow these cases. It really points out that it appears to be the case that the lawsuits are being abused, that just for the purpose of identifying the posters, the cases are being filed. There's never any determination made whether the claims are valid or not, whether they're completely bogus lawsuits. But the end result is that people are being identified. And the real problem here is that the users are never given notice of the fact that these lawsuits are pending or that the subpoenas have been issued. Typically, in the case of Yahoo, for instance, they do not notify their users that they have received the subpoena. A subpoena comes in, they say, okay, this is the information we have about this individual, whether it's an email address that the person has registered with, or apparently more commonly lately, IP address information, again, being able to link particular logons by their users to IP addresses and turning that over. There's a case pending in California right now where Yahoo turned over the IP information that led them to MSN. MSN was then subpoenaed, and to their credit, MSN does have a policy of notifying its subscribers and giving them an opportunity to go into court to challenge the issuance of the subpoena. AOL also seems to do that, although in the case of almost all of these ISPs, there is not a written policy. Yes? Right. You're right that in the criminal context, in a criminal investigation, when there is a law enforcement subpoena under ECPA, and remember, it's only in a law enforcement context that federal law requires a subpoena, there can be a confidentiality requirement to the ISP where they are told they are not to disclose the fact that the subpoena has been issued and that the individual is under investigation. There's really no civil equivalent to that. So in a civil lawsuit, there is no gag order like that put on the ISP or whoever is receiving the subpoena.
With the exception of Canada, because in Philip's case, it was done ex parte, and they were told not to tell the user.
Okay, then that's a characteristic of Canadian law that I'm not familiar with. But in the United States, the norm, at least, unless some exceptional circumstances would be shown, is that the ISP is not prohibited from disclosing the fact that the information has been requested. So the problem here is that it is typically a major corporation seeking the information up against nobody because they have filed a lawsuit against John Doe. John Doe is not given notice either of the pending lawsuit or the subpoena. So the subpoena is issued. There's no one there to challenge it because no one who has an interest in maintaining their own identity has knowledge of all of this. So the subpoenas are issued. So the problem here is that there's no contest. We're not getting cases coming before the courts where John Doe is present and arguing in favor of his anonymity and against the disclosure. So it's been very difficult to get a legal handle on this problem because a judge never gets involved in this proceeding. A lawyer who files the lawsuit can issue the subpoena. The company that receives it is then free to just release the information. And the first that the target of the lawsuit knows that all of this has happened is when he's contacted by the attorney for the plaintiff company saying, we know who you are, we know what you posted, this lawsuit is now pending against you. So it's as I say, it's very difficult to get any precedents established, and what we're trying hard to do right now is basically to get the word out that these cases do need to be challenged, that if people are aware of a subpoena in one of these cases, we're trying to hook them up with lawyers in the locations where they are, and we've actually been successful in a couple of cases in getting John Doe's together with lawyers. Most recently, there was a case in California filed by a company called Zircom. Apparently it's a modem manufacturer. Against the John Doe, and through a variety of circumstances, he became aware of the fact that the subpoena was issued. He was able to get counsel in California where the case was pending, and that case was just recently settled. Basically, there was a procedure worked out where his identity was confidentially disclosed to the attorneys for Zircom. Everyone was satisfied that he was not a former employee, that he wasn't revealing confidential information, so that case has gone away. But the issue still remains as to how we're going to tackle this problem nationwide and get some good precedents established. Now, and on the anonymity front generally, I mean, not in the context of these cases, but as a principle, we do have some good legal precedents. The Supreme Court, just about 3 years ago, in a case called McIntyre, came out very strongly in support of the right of anonymity and held that the First Amendment protects the right to speak anonymously. The context of that case was a challenge to a state campaign financing law that requires that any campaign literature that's distributed has to identify the person who's distributing the information. That was challenged, and the Supreme Court, as I said, did strike down that statute as being a violation of the First Amendment because of its assault on anonymity. Yes? The question is whether the compulsory speech issue has ever been raised in these anonymity cases. The answer is there haven't been many anonymity cases, and the few that the court has dealt with have been decided on First Amendment grounds. So that issue has not yet come up. Let me just, in talking about McIntyre, read a very quick little quote from Justice Stevens' majority opinion in the case. And this is about as good as stuff coming out of the Supreme Court gets, as far as I'm concerned. He said, anonymity exemplifies the purpose behind the First Amendment, to protect unpopular individuals from retaliation and their ideas from suppression at the hand of an intolerant society. So the idea of protecting the kind of people that we worry about online has been recognized by the Supreme Court. And you know, I can talk a little bit about, you know, the kinds of people and the kinds of situations where anonymity is important. Internationally, recently, you might be aware of the fact that an anonymous server was set up for people in Kosovo, for instance, to talk about atrocities that were being committed, because otherwise, I mean, this is an obvious problem. How do people getting that kind of information out on the internet do that without putting themselves in some very serious danger? So technology was brought to bear to give them the capability to get the information out anonymously. Chinese dissidents have, for instance, who are located in the United States, who are trying to get information over the internet into China, obviously have a serious interest in preserving their anonymity and getting that information out. Corporate or governmental whistleblowers want to get information out without revealing their identities. As the McVeigh case indicates, gay people have an interest. People with diseases or people who are involved in online alcoholism support groups. And then another recent phenomenon that we've seen has been websites set up to criticize for the specific purpose of criticizing companies. And these are basically places where consumers can post complaints about particular companies. And many of these companies have tried to go after these websites. So obviously that's another area where people, if we're going to use the internet in the way that all of us think it should be used, people need the ability to get a lot of this information out anonymously, because as the Supreme Court recognized, they really do open themselves up to some serious problems if they have to go online knowing that they're likely to be identified after they post the information. And this really is a growing phenomenon. There's been very little information that's come out of any of the ISPs or the websites that have been the targets of subpoenas. But, for instance, the Silicon Investor website is currently reporting, or at least a couple months ago, was reporting that they're getting about 10 subpoenas a month. And I think that's going to grow exponentially as this starts to become a common litigation tactic. When word gets out within the corporate legal world that this is a great way to shut people up, I think we're really going to see an avalanche of subpoenas to ISPs and websites. So that's the legal situation, which I guess brings us to the technological solutions. And all of you know a lot more about that than I do. Yes, take the question. Well, I mean, I guess the question is, in the defamation case, what's the situation where the information is true? That gets us to the whole question, and that's the crux of this issue, which is anonymity versus accountability. How do we distinguish which cases are the legitimate ones where there should be accountability and those where there are abuses? And I think that's a very difficult issue. I think all of us can acknowledge that there are cases where people should probably not have the ability to hide their acts behind anonymity. And in fact, in McIntyre, the Supreme Court recognized that there are going to be abuses of anonymity. But they said if you balance the benefits versus the harms, it looks like the benefits far outweigh the potential abuses. And the Supreme Court, for instance, cited the fact that the Federalist Papers were published under pseudonyms. So this is nothing new. And, you know, we do have a history in this country of protecting anonymity and recognizing the important role that it does play in public discourse. But that, what you raise is the problem. Yes, there are going to be cases where there are abuses of anonymity, and I think we need to find a way to sort out the good cases from the bad cases. But right now there is no way, because anybody can file a lawsuit, regardless of how bogus it might be, and identify whoever they're trying to identify. So we need to establish some system for checking the merits of these cases before people's identities are released wholesale. Yes? Not to my knowledge, but the problem is we don't even know about the vast majority of these cases. We've succeeded in identifying only about 15 cases. I mean, actually being able to cite the case name and the court that it's pending in and the docket number. But I really do think it's only the tip of the iceberg, and I'm sure there are cases where the subpoenas are not being executed because of a practical impossibility in identifying the posters. Yes? Yes.
What is in common, these two issues? What is driving?
The question is, what are the similarities here with asset forfeiture statutes? And I think it's a very good comparison. There is a due process issue involved in both of these instances, that on the one hand, you shouldn't have your property seized until there's been some determination of your guilt. And on the anonymity side of things, there should be, you should have some right to due process before your identity is disclosed, because in many instances, people's identities are important to them, if not more so than their property. So I think there is a similarity, and there does need to be some due process applied in these cases. Well, of course, in the asset forfeiture context, you're talking about the government. In the John Doe situations, you're talking about the private sector. But I, as I say, there is still a common due process problem. And I think, you know, you could say it's large institutions against individuals is certainly a common element here. But I do want to turn just briefly to the technical side of this, because I think what I've said probably illustrates the fact that there is not, at least currently, adequate legal protection. So we do need to look on the technical side, and some very good work in this area has already been done. I mean, Austin is at Zero Knowledge Systems is really focusing on this issue. There are anonymous remailers, although the two-way aspect of anonymous remailers is problematic, as we saw in the Finland situation, and Helsingius did have to take his server down because of the problems that he had in the Scientology cases. So I think, unless someone here can correct me, I think that remains a problem that still hasn't been solved in terms of how you can have two-way anonymous remailers so that I can post something anonymously and then allow people to respond to me.
David?
Yes, please.
That works. We've got them.
Good.
Yeah, it existed before. It's called NIM servers. And so NIM servers allow you to create a pseudonym and create encrypted delivery instructions to get it back. We've done a variation of that, so you can have full bidirectional communication for email, IRC, web, SSH, Telnet, and it's completely anonymous, where we don't even know. So you
do not hold any information that would be of value to law enforcement,
no.
Or.
This is the reason. So if we get a subpoena, we can turn over everything we have, which is encrypted data. That's okay. You know, 128 bits. Good luck.
Okay. Well, I'm happy to be corrected on that point. The other technology is anonymous proxy servers, and Richard Windman this morning talked about the DEF CON proxy server. I think that's a very important capability, and I think that really needs to be explored more and expanded upon. I'll just say one of the problems, and I spoke to Richard about this, and he says that at the moment it is a problem, is that these servers, the URLs for these servers, are of course subject to being put in blocking lists in filtering software programs, particularly in a workplace situation. You know, I talked about corporate whistleblowers. It is obviously easy enough for a workplace to block access to the anonymous proxy servers, so I think that's still a problem that needs to be gotten around. I'm looking to Austin, but it looks like there is not yet a solution to that.
As long as the firewall or any access control allows any UDP or any TCP traffic through, we can run anonymous IP through it, either in UDP or TCP, and we can let you connect to the anonymous network for web browsing, IRC, whatever protocol you want. So it's very, very hard to ban our service. So if, like, China wanted to ban, on a country level, access to the Freedom Network, it would be next to impossible. They would have to proxy everything and have a very restrictive policy for all proxying, including DNS, everything.
Okay.
So.
Thank you again. Yes.
You mentioned that the FBI was talking about using caller IDs, mandating that ISPs record that information for later subpoena or whatever. Unless they're an 800 number or an emergency service and you block your own ID, that information isn't available to just a general number. Are they talking about giving ISPs the equivalent of an emergency line where they can get a caller ID off of all numbers?
Free did not address that issue. I mean, but I would assume that if they become serious about really mandating it, then obviously they're going to have to build in the capability. And for those of you who have followed the CALEA debate for the last few years, you know that it's certainly not unprecedented for law enforcement to dictate standards as to how the phone system is going to operate. And I would anticipate that is a likely requirement if we do move forward in that direction. So how does that relate to this?
I don't think you can block outgoing ISDN caller ID.
Okay. Yes.
Not to put a note of cynicism.
Okay, I certainly can't add or subtract anything to that because I gave a disclaimer that the technical side of things is not my forte. Yes.